Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare career development, and healthcare leadership. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to these terms. Whether you're sipping your morning coffee, commuting to the hospital, or just looking for a dose of inspiration, we've got you covered. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. Pemba On Demand will allow you to be an even bigger force for good in healthcare. Welcome back to Pemba On Demand, a podcast brought to you by the University of Tennessee Haslam College of Business and their Physician Executive MBA program. I'm your host, Norm Chapin. Today's guest is someone who has quietly been doing some of the most important and underappreciated work in American healthcare, and doing it across 9 Western states, which is either inspiring or exhausting, depending on how you feel about airports. Dr. Tiffany Humph is a regional medical director for post-acute care at Team Health, where she oversees skilled nursing facilities, long-term care facilities, LTACs, and independent rehab facilities across the Western U.S. She's been with Team Health since 2011, a tenure that started when her independent hospitalist practice was acquired by IPC, which was later acquired by Team Health, which, if you think about it, is basically a modern physician origin story. Tiffany's currently a student in the PEMBA program, and her organizational action project centers on something that should be keeping every hospital administrator up at night: improving care transitions from the acute hospital setting to post-acute care, and keeping patients from bouncing back. Given that nearly 1 in 4 post-acute patients gets readmitted to the hospital within 30 days, this isn't a small problem. She's already shown it's not an unsolvable one either. We're going to talk to her today about her leadership journey, why she chose the MBA at this stage of a very full career, the challenges facing post-acute care in the age of the silver tsunami, and what it takes to run a physician executive role across 9 states while still finding time to see patients. Dr. Tiffany Humph, welcome to Pemba On Demand. Well, Tiffany, welcome to Pemba On Demand. It's exciting to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Norm. My pleasure to be here. Very exciting.
I appreciate it. I've been looking forward to this for some time now as we've been discussing this. I thought we might start tonight by just having you share with us a little bit some of the projects that you're working on right now that have you most energized.
Energized, that's a good word. I am energized. I have a couple of topics that are near and dear to my heart that I'm constantly working on. I think the first and foremost is the acute to post-acute program, which is also being paired nicely with my MBA and will provide substance for my organizational action project. So there's that. And then as a part of that, there is the readmission reduction program, and that kind of goes the other direction. So that's post-acute back to acute. We're trying to really minimize those transitions and keep them where the patient can be in the best place of care all the time. And that is a challenge, I will say.
So talk a little bit about the acute to post-acute transition. What are the main challenges that you're facing there? What's the main problem that you're trying to solve in those types of transitions?
Yeah. Well, the key is coordination of care and care continuity. What you're really trying to be successful with is when a patient needs rehabilitation and they need to come to a nursing home to get better because they're too ill or too weak otherwise to go home. There's a certain amount of data that we need in order to take really good care. And sometimes we're siloed when we come from the hospital setting over to the post-acute setting, Generally, these establishments are owned or managed by two different entire organizations. Usually that's the case. And communication may be poor. It all goes back to communication and what we're getting. I think the post-acute clinician, it's not like the olden days where nursing homes had a doctor once a month and maybe someone was rounding, oh, if you got lucky, a couple times per month. Those days are long gone. And CMS has noted that the medical director and the medical care that's contracted in a nursing facility is one of the most important factors to preventing readmissions to the hospital. We help with policy, we help with transitions, all of the above, not to mention our medical expertise, right? Patients are leaving the hospital sicker. Their length of stay, perhaps, it could have been long, but again, length of stay is shortening in the hospital. They're urged to discharge these patients quicker, so they come to us sicker. And what we need from them is really a concise summary of what happened. And sometimes that happens, and sometimes that does not happen. So the key is that discharge summary. The key is making sure our facilities have all the prescriptions they need so they don't have to go back to the emergency department to get their pain pills. The key is making that as seamless as possible so the patient can feel comfortable immediately. It's never good when they're waiting on the pharmacy. We're waiting on documents or orders. We have to make it seamless. And that's what this program really is all about. Acute to post-acute means seamless transitions where the patient comes first and the facility is able to do their job timely.
And are you finding that the acute care hospitals are more willing or less willing to partner to help design these well-executed handoffs and transitions?
They are eager to help. I think it's important to recognize that there's penalties on both sides for readmissions to the hospital. There's penalties, of course, in the hospital sector. Medicaid patients, you know, they come in and it can be heavy monetary penalties. And readmissions on the post-acute side are also no good. It changes their reimbursement rate at that level. Not to mention it changes their five-star CMS quality ratings and all of the other things that go along with that. So there is a heavy, heavy desire to partner. I think the key is getting us out of our silos and making it a more smooth transition, because a lot of times they can say they want the program, but they don't recognize that there might need to be some movement on both sides in order to make it really, really happen well.
One of the things that I think we've seen happen over the past several decades, let's say, is this transition of the inpatient rounding and the medical staff rounding of nursing homes to a more of a hospitalist type of program on the inpatient side. And I think a similar change on the post-acute side, where you have more well-organized structure around the rounding and who's responsible for patients. How has that impacted this issue? And in hospitals where you still have an independent medical staff rounding versus an organized hospitalist team, how does it look different?
I would say more and more we are taking that route of the hospitalist movement. We call it the SNFist movement, if you will, mm-hmm. The skilled nursing facility movement, the SNFist. Our SNFists, really, they are that. And I would say the best kinds of doctors that come into nursing facilities actually have played a role as hospitalists. The interesting thing about a hospitalist is they know exactly what is admit-worthy, what is observation, what needs to go to the emergency department, what can actually occur in a facility, what kind of therapies we are able to do in place. And it can be a harder transition for others. I think hospitalists, ER doctors, they really do, having some exposure to the hospital really makes that a benefit for the facility and patient to have that kind of experience. But now more than ever, I think we really do want our SNFists to be just SNFists. We want them to embrace this like it is their full-time job for sure. And they're there at a scheduled presence. They are making sure they know all the patients. They are rounding at an expected cadence. And they're partnered with a really amazing team. So we generally, in all of the facilities, well, I would say most of them, at least 95% of the facilities that are under my umbrella here in the Weston Desert, we pair them with APCs. Mm-hmm. And the advanced practice clinician is what that stands for. They do the bread and butter of the medicine. They really do. In the best case scenario, they could be there 5 to 7 days per week. Some facilities are large enough, we do have to staff them more like a hospital where we have a team in. We may have to offer supportive services like cardiac care, palliative care, behavioral health. These are all needs in the facility. So the model has most certainly changed. Those days of just popping in and seeing patients and having a nursing home really be run by nursing is a thing of the past.
Mm-hmm. I know right now your organizational action project that you're working on in your MBA is you're sort of working with a major health system outside of your region to pilot a strategy. Talk to us a little bit about that and what has surprised you about working in that project.
It's exciting. The acute to post-acute program was initially designed by my company to focus on the bridge of transitions between our own hospitalists and our own post-acute clinicians. And if done correctly with the correct collaborative approach, it works really well. It works really well. We've got some case in point and we just wrote a white paper about it. And it is amazing what you can do to decrease geometric length of stay of the hospital and have really improved transitions, not to mention way reduced readmissions to acute. So that's how we modeled it initially. So this is one of the first times we've actually done, I would say, a more of an innovative approach with a health system that is, we didn't necessarily have our own hospitalists or ER doctors on the inside. And so in this health system, they really had a problem. Their length of stay is running exquisitely long. They are having issues discharging to facilities on the weekends. They're having readmissions that they don't want because it hurts. Of course, it hurts patients, but it also hurts bottom line. And ultimately, kind of was a joint venture where they came to us and they said, hey, we need some help. And we said, we know how to do this. What we need from you is buy-in. We need your stature within the community to help us to grow and help us to take care of your health system's patients. I think you asked what surprised me about that. You would think, if you're doing the right thing and you know this is the right thing, we can help you because we've proven it time and time again with our other programs. You would think that would be easy. It'd be a no-brainer for the hospital, right? But again, the silos come into play. And the true span of control of the hospital over individual nursing facilities throughout the community may not be as great as we would like it to be. Because truthfully, these patients only have so many places that they can go. And they have to pick a facility that their insurance will take and that they are able to get care. So again, for a health system to say, hey, we want you to allow Dr. Hamp's company to take care of these patients, they're like, but we have a medical director, but we have a team. So from a cultural perspective, it doesn't play out like that, right? You have to have proof of concept. And more recently, we've had some success. This was in the Indiana area, and we just had a facility change over to us to where they're asking us to be the medical director. They were unsatisfied with their contracted medical services, and we're going to have a really amazing opportunity. This is how we show the health system what we can do compared to what was happening everywhere else. Mm-hmm. So you have to wait for those little leads sometimes. You have to wait for that little blossom of something wonderful happening, and it doesn't happen overnight. And that's always a little surprising to me because you would think it would just be so easy.
Yes. I think that's the way we find many things in medicine when we try to innovate. There's so many barriers that we uncover as we try to advance quality outcomes for patients. It is a little bit surprising, and sometimes it's a little frustrating, I think, for us, for
that
me.
Too. That too. Yes, 100%.
So do you see that these relationships, and obviously you're working with organizations, post-acute facilities, it sounds like, that are not all staffed by you're a provider, so you're having to pull different levers to try to create change, it sounds like.
We really do. Yeah, we do. And our focus is, of course, helping the hospital first and foremost with my organizational action plan, right? Helping this health system reduce their geometric length of stay and readmissions, mm-hmm. of course. That's the value proposition for them. For us, it's really helping these facilities be the best that they can be, improving their CMS star ratings, improving their readmission rates, improving their transitions of care, ensuring that they don't have to do as much work and that we're true partners in this right along with them. And again, it really comes from a multitude of things. I mean, we have all these programs in place, making sure that they have adequate night coverage and night call systems and can get the help that they need when they need it. The source of dissatisfaction from competitors generally comes from a lack of some of that. So our goal is to always make them look as great as they can, even though I think I may have mentioned it before when you and I spoke, but the clinician is our customer with my company. It's not the facility. We do believe that if our clinicians are taken really great care of, and we do that as a company, and we teach them the correct way to do things, and we influence them through our workflows, believe that it all trickles downhill. They take care of the facility, and the facility takes care of the patients, and then you're serving all those customers at once. But first and foremost is retaining and recruiting excellent talent that has that same idea and wants a forever career.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was, when we did talk about that in preparation for this, it was sort of an intriguing way to frame it, I guess. I think we all think about nowadays wellness of our practitioners, of our physicians and our APPs or APCs. But a lot of times I find healthcare administrators really tend to view us in a way that we're almost a commodity to them to provide care. What types of strategies have you had to have the healthcare organizations that you're working with understand and appreciate the value of this approach?
Well, I think case in point, we have so many positive relationships, and it all comes back to communication. And when we are able to communicate with our clinicians and have them establish the relationship with the facility, because it is the expected process, it is the expected workflow, it is what we expect of maintaining your job and book of business, we generally find that they're really, really accepting. Mm-hmm. When they find their clinical team that they want to keep as their forever team, these facilities cannot be chased away. They know that their care is superior. Their five-star QMs completely reflect it. Engagement is palpable. And so when that happens, we don't have to talk them into it. It's, of course, you have to prove yourself at the beginning. But again, we don't have to talk them into it once they recognize they have an engaged clinical community in their mm-hmm. building.
Okay. So getting back a little bit to the, I want to get your thoughts on the scope of this readmission mm-hmm. problem between post-acute facilities and back into the hospitals. I'm much more familiar with, I guess, readmission rates overall, and specifically, since I work in an ambulatory environment right now, we're focused on reducing readmissions, but it's from those patients that get discharged home. And we really mm-hmm. don't interact very much with patients that are transferred into rehab facilities or post-acute. So what is the difference in the scope of the problem for patients who get discharged home versus people who go into post-acute care?
Well, this is our bread and butter. So we're aware that about a 1 in 4, 1 in 5 at some locations, patients from a nursing home return to the acute. So that's not a very good rate, I would say. That means that they're not getting enough care. They're getting discharged quicker, as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. and they're not getting enough care. There's not enough attention being paid to what's changing. We recognize the drivers of readmissions. There's diagnoses that are seen far more than anything else. And that's, you know, just like in the emergency room, or just like if they were to come to your office, early recognition of sepsis, very, very important, or infections. Congestive heart failure is huge. In our facility, I hate to say it, but there's a lot of falls that precipitate return to at least the emergency department for additional testing. And, you know, we can see where this comes from. We have very powerful programs in which we analyze our data, our call data. We know that about 40% of the time, families and patients call 911 or drive themselves back into the acute care setting. And what does that mean from a post-acute perspective, a clinician perspective? That means that we may not have established enough rapport. The patient didn't feel safe, meaning they didn't think we could take care of them in the facility, so they felt the need to return to the hospital. Now, I suppose there are those patients that just like to go back to the hospital. That exists. There are those people that call 911 for everything, and you know they visit a lot. But the key is recognizing the drivers of return to acute and recognizing what things you can help and what things you can. We generally feel like it falls into two other buckets, and that's either you can't care for that patient at the facility timely, meaning you can't get lab work or radiology there quickly enough to have a satisfactory answer. And I mean, there's also the capacity of the nursing staff and the staffing, which is problematic at times. In all facilities. And then the other, our own barriers. It's just something we can't care for. And those are the patients that are the authentic people that should be sent back to the hospital, right? They have a condition that needs emergent care. So the key is trying to reduce all those other buckets and feel good about it and doing that, keeping them away from risk and our liability down and the facility's liability down. So readmission is a huge task, and there's no one arm. You can have the best call systems. You can have the best clinicians. You can have fantastic nurses, but there's always going to be readmissions. And in many places where I have very engaged staff, we have single-digit readmission rates in our facilities. And that's all we strive for, really, is getting it half of national, half of state average. Mm-hmm. That is considered a real success.
I was going to ask you what you, because I think getting to zero is
no,
not possible. I was going to ask you what you thought a realistic, achievable target was when you get involved in these partnerships. And you just kind of answer that question.
Well, I think knowing that most state averages are slightly, a little bit lower than usually the national average of 22.8 or 23%, right about. I really feel good when we've got readmission rates right around the 15 or lower percent rate. Okay. That is means that you are doing everything in your power and the facility is helping you. They are doing everything in their power to be really great stewards of resources and make sure they're really paying attention to those patients.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, struck me as we were preparing for this and as we're talking now is that I talk to a lot of medical students. I talk to a lot of residents who are in training, both in family medicine and internal medicine. It's kind of unusual to have somebody come out of the pipeline in their residency with an aspiration to go into post-acute care. How did you end up in post-acute care and how did you develop a passion for this work?
Well, I will say I walked out of residency into a hospitalist job. So I'm a retired hospitalist, we'll call myself. I'm a recovering hospitalist. And I did that for 12 years. I started post-acute while I was a hospitalist. I did some hybrid work and I was attracted to it from a colleague of mine said, hey, I need a medical director for one of these buildings. You know, would you be interested? And I have to say, I love this first building that I was ever medical director of. I would say they had a very affluent, very elderly population, and they were the most fun to take care of. They were just like amazing. And I've always enjoyed taking care of people. I love being a hospitalist. I'm not going to lie. The pace was amazing. My partners were amazing. No day was the same twice. It was fun. But it was also a recipe for burnout at the time when I was doing it. And I was pulling in 60 to 80 hour weeks. And it was not something that I felt like I could sustain any longer with small children. And so you ask about post-acute, and I think you're right. Nobody goes to medical school and says, gosh, I think I want to be a nursing home, you know, physician. That is not the specialty people are looking for. It's not glamorous like plastic surgery or like dermatology or ophthalmology. It's just nobody thinks about that. But I will tell you, from a lifestyle perspective, from a quality of life, work-life balance perspective, I think it's the best place in medicine. There's no place I'd rather be. When I came into full-time post-acute work, which was about almost 9 years ago now, when I changed completely, I did it without looking back. It was just a wonderful way to transition, to have good, meaningful living and take really great care of people, create relationships to where you have your skilled patients that are like your hospitalized patients. They're that sick. So never a dull moment. And then you have the long-term care patients, which are like your clinic patients. So you know their families, you know all their medical issues, you know their dog and their, you know, their husband comes in on Sundays, you know exactly all the things about them like you would in a primary care clinic. So it was like the best thing in the world. Doesn't get better. And you got to make your schedule and got to raise my children and they're teenagers and here we are.
So yeah. When you moved into post-acute care initially, it sounds like you had a little bit of an administrative role and also a clinical role. How has that changed now that you're one of six regional medical directors for Team Health?
It has changed for the best. I love clinical work. I don't do as much anymore, but I do some. I feel that's important for my leadership journey and in order to understand what my clinicians and doctors are going through on any given day. My hope is that it makes me a stronger leader and that, you know, I can lead by example and help them if they need it. I would say as a regional medical director, as one of six, it is a very rewarding role. It is a role I honestly didn't think I was going to get to. I was contemplating leaving my company because I had hit a relative glass ceiling where I wasn't going to be able to break through that glass, or I didn't think I was going to be able to break through that glass. And there were some transitions in the leadership and I was offered that opportunity and it was a wonderful transition. I think I'd been ready for it for a long time. I'd actually considered going back and getting an MBA in preparation for a chief medical officer role at a hospital, like a community hospital that was interested in me. And it was when this came along, it made me recognize that I kind of had it all along. And this was just an amazing segue into a different type of leadership than I had done before. I'd done hospital leadership prior to that. You know, I'd been a medical staff president. I'd been the credentialing chair for 15 years. You know, I mean, I was heavy into medical staff bylaws and all of the things. But I will say this was an opportunity to lead on a multifaceted level where I have a wonderful vice president of operations who's my dyad partner. We always pair the clinical with the operations. And I have a wonderful leadership team, including all of the regional medical directors that I work with. We have a very collaborative approach to post-acute care, the service line. Like I told you, everything we do and everything we think about has the clinician first in mind. And even though we all are responsible for our own, you know, multimillion dollar budgets and many states, I've got the eight here over on the west end desert. It is impactful because we run it similarly. Our group president calls it the Starbucks approach. I don't know if I'm allowed to say Starbucks on a podcast, but Starbucks does the same thing in Miami that it does in Seattle, right? The drinks come out the same. And while healthcare is very local, we feel we are able to impact healthcare in a more standardized way by amazing programs that we bring, but always with them first. We are very cautious to not burden them with extra tasks, extra clicks. The clicks are horrible, like on when you're dealing with technology. Anything we implement comes with them first in our mind.
Okay. This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So with that being said, and it sounds like you have broad support for that across the company, which is fantastic. What is, in your current role as a regional medical director with that sort of a large area that you're responsible for, if there is a normal week, what does that look like? And how, you mentioned you're not practicing as much clinically as you did, but what percentage of your time is spent in clinical practice versus administrative?
Yeah, so I am the medical director for two nursing facilities close to where I live. I am a straight medical director where I don't do clinical services at one. And at the other one, I provide medical director and clinical services one day a week. So it's about 10 to 20% of my time is spent clinically. The rest is all my regional medical director job. I sit on so many committees and it's actually fantastic. I think a day in the life of me, I have a lot of meetings. I won't lie. There is a lot going on. Last year, we launched an ACO. So it is real-time learning about value-based care and how those transitions occur. We are very, very focused, I would say, on our clinical initiatives. And those, again, they surround the patient care workflow and helping to reduce readmissions, best care, best practices. Mm-hmm. So a lot of them incorporate along with the ACO, but we were doing them all before, right? Diabetes management, hypertension management, helping us track how we're doing in some of these measures, ensuring that patients have a meaningful goals of care conversation and advanced care planning. This is really important, especially when you have to stay or potentially live in a nursing home. We should know what your wishes are, and we should know what your family thinks about all of this. There's just so many facets where the initiatives are playing a role in our clinicians' everyday lives. Mm-hmm. So anything we can do to help them, I would say, bridge the barrier of, we don't want to put it all on them. We want to make it easy for them to help us capture this data and make sure that we're doing the right things for our patients. Technology plays a role in that, obviously. Implemented call systems and applications to get sign out. We have a care coordination program where we actually have scheduled visits put in by the night call. So we ensure follow-up will be timely. There, all of these programs meld and they all are married. This suite, we actually call it Smart Pack. And Smart Pack is our suite and our value proposition to our facilities and to our clinicians also, right? The patients, they get the benefit of all of that.
It sounds amazing the way that you're organizing everything and the amount of thought that goes into how you achieve these kinds of results. But it sounds just amazing and very rewarding.
It is. It is. What, you know, I think we're a really collaborative bunch. Sometimes, perhaps even overly collaborative. You know, there are the, but I think we're very mindful of each other. It is a, we're a little biased, but with the company, we think that the best service line is the post-acute service line. And for years, we're not the biggest. We're one of the smallest in the company. Mm-hmm. Our company has Team Health houses anesthesia and emergency medicine and hospital medicine, and a variety of other subspecialists. And post-acute, for a long time, we were just at a leadership conference and we used to be the redheaded stepchild. We don't think of ourselves like that anymore. We finally are mentioned on the national stage. We're finally doing things that would equate to the excellence that Team Health is known for. And that has taken some time because it's a smaller service line and we're very siloed and we're very spread out. Yeah. The key is unsiloing, standardizing, and making sure our clinicians are with us for the long haul.
Yeah.
Retaining that excellence.
So I'd like to pivot for a minute and talk about your MBA. It's kind of come up tangentially in your conversation. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you had thought about pursuing an MBA at a different point in your career. You're currently in the Physician Executive MBA at the University of Tennessee currently for this year.
I am. I love it.
And what made this seem like the best time for you to pursue the MBA based on you've got tons of experience, many, many different responsibilities and leadership opportunities that you've had and the role that you're already in without having the MBA? Why did this seem like something that you really wanted or needed to pursue?
And as I said, I'd been thinking about it for some time. One of my colleagues at Team Health, a regional medical director colleagues, had gone ahead and done the program, and she was singing its praises, saying it's unlike anything you've ever done. And when you think about an MBA, there's really no good time ever. I mean, can you think of when it's like an ideal or good time to go back to school while you have a full-time job and a full family and, you know, you're a wife and mom and or husband and, you know, dad, whatever it may mean. But I think, you know, I was strongly influenced by my boss, my group president, and he just felt passionate. He's like, I said, I think it would serve you well. He really looked at it like it would be something that I'd be doing just for me. And while I hadn't thought of it that way, it really is something that I'm doing just for me. And I kind of proposed it to the family. And of course, they were in agreement. I've got teenagers. They don't need me now. They like for mom to be hands off. So this was kind of it really, if there was an ideal time, this really was it. And the amount of people that I had heard who went through this program and the fact that it was an accelerated year that you could also be a little bit in person was very attractive. Mm-hmm. I saw this, I don't even remember where I saw it, but it was one of the guys from Shark Tank, and I can't remember which one it was, but he had said, you should always get as much education as you can afford. And he was talking about monetarily, but I think that comes in a bigger picture, right? Mm-hmm. That you can afford with your lifestyle and of course, monetarily also, but it just seemed like it was the right thing to do. And I was so, I'm just elated that I'm in and getting to enjoy this process.
It sounded like you had a lot of recommendations for PEMBA itself. And I know Team Health, their headquarters is in Tennessee. And I think there's a real strong relationship between the University of Tennessee and Team Health from that perspective. Did you look at other executive MBA programs?
I didn't. This was the only one I looked at.
Okay.
Yeah. I liked the 1 year and I couldn't argue that at all. Yeah. It was just, it sounded like it was going to be perfect.
Great.
For what I was looking for.
So as you've gotten into it, we all go into these types of experiences with expectations. What has been one of the biggest aha moments or surprises that you've had about the MBA experience so far?
You know, I think it's been a long time since I've been in school. And this is so different, even than medical school, definitely different than undergrad. I think what surprises me is the caliber of the professors. I had no idea there were such smart people out there, I think was part of it. And you know, not knowing all the things you're going to learn, it's really the breadth of knowledge that I will leave here with is fairly profound. I mean, you think I'm going to get a business degree. You're like, okay, I'm going to learn about finance and I'm going to learn about economics. And I mean, you have a couple that are the given, right? What you don't understand is that you're going to learn about business development and business planning. And you're going to learn about how to recruit and retain great talent. And that you're going to learn lean principles and performance improvement. So the caliber of the professors, I think, was, I just couldn't even believe it. These are like some of the smartest people I've ever been around. I kind of feel like maybe I shouldn't be in the room with them at times because I'm not bright enough. But it is especially amazing. The other piece of that are my classmates. You are all in a spot in your life where you've decided you are going to entertain an MBA. And we're there because we want to be there. And that is a very different experience from any school that I've had before. You are there because you're dedicated to the fact that you are going to engage in ongoing learning and do this forever and better yourself in this way. And that's different than it was when you're a younger individual. We're all many years in practice. We come from all walks of life. We've got anesthesiologists and vascular surgeons and, you know, ER doctors and family practice. And it's just amazing and how like-minded and really just, I'm so impressed with the talent. So impressed.
What would you tell somebody who might have been like you a year and a half ago, who had kind of thought about it but never really pulled the trigger on it, who's just kind of on the fence about whether an executive MBA can really enhance their career, or maybe not even their career, but just their, as you said, doing it for themselves.
I would say there's never going to be the perfect time, I would say. And I would just bring it back to the fact that it's such an incredible experience being in, I'm trying to come up with the correct words, but being in the presence of people that care so much about the future of healthcare. And I care a lot. Was I sure I wanted to do an MBA? Maybe not. But it, like, I couldn't be happier that I pulled the trigger to do that, because I do feel like I'm going to make a greater impact. I do think whether I end up elevating my career or not, I certainly hope I do. That would be wonderful. But if it doesn't happen, it is amazing how much more I can take away and how much more I'll be able to do for our patients and facilities, and most importantly, the clinicians that I serve.
Thank you. Thanks for answering that. The one thing you mentioned earlier that intrigued me a little bit was that you mentioned that you'd kind of considered leaving post-acute care because you felt like you were kind of bumping up against a glass ceiling. What was that related to, in your opinion? I know that women are still underrepresented at the physician executive level. Was your experience or your barrier gender related, or did you think there was something else that was playing a role in why you were not necessarily being considered for or tapped for a more broad leadership role?
I don't specifically think it had to do with my gender. I think the ceiling came from a collection of poor leadership that had been in place for a really long time.
Okay.
And while I loved post-acute, the capacity to make changes was nil. And I really thought, I didn't see a way out that they were ever going to change or lead. Now, keep in mind, the post-acute was young at this time, so leaders were in place, but it really required a restructuring. And when I joined, it was the beginning of the restructure. When I joined in leadership, that is. So I felt like there wasn't anywhere to go. I was never going to make it to the next rung. And it had to do with just being, you know, it was a perfect example of the leader I never wanted to be. Okay. Because I couldn't stand it. As much as I love my job and as much freedom as I had to do good for my patients, it doesn't feel good when you're micromanaged or only called out when things aren't going particularly well. And I go back to that a lot. It's the leader I never wanted to be. And that was the reason I thought I was going to leave. And I didn't know if I was going to leave post-acute or and go back to the hospital, which is what I suspected I was going to do, was go back to the hospital. But I really didn't know. That was when I was looking around. And I suppose you said, did I ever look at any other MBA programs? Well, I did back then. Mm-hmm. I had, but that was kind of the driver. It looked like that I was kind of trapped in my position, and that's never a good feeling. And that's why I will say with my company, and it's very important to me, that we are succession planning. We are thinking about who might want to take the reins next, who would enjoy this type of thing. Are there positions we haven't even thought of yet that would benefit our service line? And we've created a lot of them, frankly. The whole economics of healthcare is changing. We're having to get creative with how our service line makes money, you know, because Medicare just wants to cut us. They're not in it to give us a big raise. And nor will they ever be, I suspect. So with that, we have to figure out other ways to keep our clinicians whole. And that's where, you know, value-based care and accountable care organization and all the things are coming to fruition.
Well, we're kind of getting near the end of our time. There's one area that I wondered if you could just opine on for a minute for me, and that's the dyad partnership. How do you explain a dyad partnership to someone who's never experienced it? What makes it work and what would break it?
Well, a funny little story. I have an amazing vice president of operations. She is my dyad partner. We are like an old married couple now. I think we can finish each other's sentences. We're pretty sure we know what the other's answer will be with anything post-acute related, maybe anything altogether, but it did not start out that way. Team health is basically dyaded the entire from leadership all the way down. We have operations paired with the clinical teams, from the group president, our executive vice president, who are the clinical and ops leader for the service line. even higher up as you go up to team health when you're talking about the chief medical officer and all of that, and all the, some of the folks that I'm sure you know. But I will say we weren't always that way. And what will break that relationship, of course, is not communicating or thinking that one person's job is more important than the other's. I think once you accept the fact you both have a particular skill set and absolutely you could not do the other one's job, that's where a dyad really is fantastic. She has special sets of skills that I know not of. I feel like my MBA, I am understanding them a lot better than I used to. And I have clinical skills that she could never try to navigate on her own. And I think that's where it works. We can just move into that spot where do we go in each other's lanes? Most certainly we do. Do we get mad at each other once in a while? Yes, of course. I mean, it is a true relationship in every sense of the world, but it is cohesive in the fact that I know that we trust each other implicitly and that we have each other's backs and we're always doing what's best for the clinician and the service line at our heart of hearts. And so I think that's how a really great dyad partnership works, is that you know you have a common goal and it's whatever you can do to make that goal succeed.
That's a great explanation. Thank you for that. It's one of the best explanations of a dyad leadership that works. And the converse, of course, is what would make it not work. But that was fantastic. Mm-hmm.
Lack of communication makes it not work. So you have to talk to each other.
And I think you mentioned also trust. I think trust is one of the real things that glues it together. Because even if I forget to communicate with my dyad partner and they trust that my intent was not to be a bad communicator or not to step into their lane, it really allows you to come back from that gaffe, you know, that mistake. But when I've been in a dyad relationship where I didn't really trust the person, I didn't know what their intent was or didn't know what to think about their behavior, those were the situations that were really difficult to remain in for me.
I would agree completely. And I mean, I've had that same experience and, you know, and trust is earned, right? Mm-hmm. It's not something that just automatically happens. It takes time to develop trust, especially when you don't know each other. Or you come from completely different walks of life, right? You've had different experiences. And we couldn't be more different when it comes to that. But, you know, over time, there is just a degree of respect that we have developed for one another and our particular skill sets. And we know we're on the same team. And that's what really makes it, what makes the trust grow and what makes for a great dyad.
It's a comfortable place to be once you get to that point.
Yeah, it took a minute, but we are very much there. So I'm very, very blessed when it comes to that.
So I want to give you just one last question to comment on, and that for our physician audience, and there's going to be alumni in the audience, there's going to be physicians who are thinking about doing an MBA, there's going to be a pretty broad, probably even some non-physicians that are out there listening, but what's the one thing that you would want every physician listening to this podcast to take away from our conversation today?
I think anytime you're considering going back to school, it's a scary thought, but I guess I would want others to know that there are ways to be impactful that you have not even dreamt of yet because you didn't have the skill set to do that. And I think that's what has been such an eye-opener from my perspective for this degree. Every day I walk out of class on Saturdays and I think of, oh, I know where I'm going to use that. Or I know how I could apply that. And you have to be exquisitely good at managing time. I'm not going to lie. You have to be organized. I've had to be more organized this year than I think I've ever had to be in my life with really ensuring I have the time to complete things the way I am wanting to complete them. Because, you know, I think as physicians, we tend to be, we'll just say a little type A. And that's what's preserved us for years and years and years in our careers. And this is an opportunity to be more impactful and more intentional with the things that you're doing already. And if you really want to be a more impactful leader, these are the skills you need.
So. Great. Well, Tiffany, again, it's been great having you on the show. I really appreciate your comments and your thoughts. And thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. You're right in the middle of your MBA program and the regional medical director. I'm amazed that you found time for this, but I really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate your time. I'm so happy to chat with you, and thank you again.
You're welcome. That was Dr. Tiffany Humph, Regional Medical Director for Post-Acute Care at Team Health and current PEMBA student at the University of Tennessee Haslam College of Business. What I love about conversations like this one is that they remind you of how much is happening in corners of medicine that don't get nearly enough attention. Post-acute care touches some of our most vulnerable patients at some of their most vulnerable moments. And having physician leaders like Tiffany thinking hard about transitions, readmissions, and what it actually means to serve clinicians well makes a real difference. If today's conversation sparks something for you, whether you're a physician thinking about your next chapter, a healthcare leader wrestling with care transition challenges, or someone who just wants to understand where our healthcare system is heading, I'd encourage you to look into the PEMBA program at UT Haslam. The link is in the show notes. And if you found value in this episode, please share it with a colleague. Leave a review wherever you listen, and follow PEMBA On Demand so you don't miss what's coming next. I'm Dr. Norm Chapin. Thanks for spending some time with us, and we'll see you for the next episode. Thanks for listening to PEMBA On Demand. We release new episodes bi-weekly, every other Thursday. You'll find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Castos. Hit follow or subscribe to us and add us to your library. If today helped you, please leave a quick review and share the show with a colleague. Questions or comments? Drop them on our YouTube channel, PEMBA On Demand. For episode links and resources, check the show notes and visit tiny.utk.edu/PEMBA On Demand, all one word. Take good care and keep becoming a bigger force for good in healthcare.